rabies, although it's a disease of extremes, although it is the most serious disease known to man, or the highest, it is eminently preventable. I'd say we've got the most effective vaccine in humans. Why can't we get that into animal health as well?
Welcome back to the World Extreme Medicine podcast with myself, Owen Walker. In this episode, we're going to be speaking around the African wild dog with Jim Bond. So what we're to do in the episode is look at the numbers of the diminishing numbers of African wild dogs across the African continent. We're going to look at the African wild dog and indeed look at the fact it remains one of the world's most critically endangered mammals due to a long history of persecution by people, poacher snares, diseases caught from contact with domestic dogs, and other factors. So the largest populations remain in the southern African and indeed southern parts of East Africa on the continent, especially around southern Tanzania and northern Mozambique. In recent years, the number of wild dogs has steadily been declining across the African continent. And what we thought we'd do in the conversation is explore why this is and what can be done to preserve this unique animal. So to do this, I have Jim Bond with me. Jim is an experienced consultant in travel and exhibition medicine based in Edinburgh. He was born and brought up in Zambia and has returned to Africa many times to work in a safari camp in Botswana as a rural hospital doctor and indeed as an expedition doctor within Madagascar and Tanzania. He's also carried out ethnobotanical ethnobotanical research and community-led TB treatment work over several years within hunter-gatherer Maka people in Madagascar, evaluated and indeed responded to community health projects on the shores of Lago Nissa, and worked within the veterinary team to eliminate the risk of rabies from Iba Island in Mozambique. Jim is an enthusiast and indeed is enthused by One Health, so especially the rabies risk reduction scheme and indeed concept. He is interested in doing more work in this area, targeting hard-to-reach communities in Zambia, Mozambique and Tanzania, aiming to protect children first and foremost, as well as domestic dogs and the critically endangered African wild dog. Welcome to the podcast, Jim.
Thank you, Owen, for having me. Thanks for the invitation.
It's great to have you with us. Jim, I just wondered if you could firstly speak to, indeed, some of the unique traits of this species of dog.
Well, I think the first thing to point out is, although it looks like a dog, in the broadest sense, it is a member of the dog family. the African wild dog, or painted wolf or painted dog, it's got at least 50 other names, is not actually a true dog or a true wolf. It's about the furthest away in the dog family that you can get from the domestic dog. So they diverge from all the other wolf-like species at least 3.9 million years ago. And its taxonomic name, Lycaon pictus, literally means a painted wolf-like thing. But all perfectly fine. I just use the name African wild dog because in Zambia that's what we call it. That's that. The unique features, well, there's three main ones. Unlike all the other members of the dog family, it only has four toes on its front feet. And that may seem dew claw. Now that may seem a point, but it does actually extend its stride considerably, so it can run. Makes it much more efficient at running and running down its prey. So it's actually the most efficient carnivore predator in Africa, with a success rate of about 70 to 80% from every hunt. It's also got these beautiful large round ears. Picture, just to show you, there's a picture. Beautiful, but large round ears. And its sense of hearing is actually better than its sense of smell. It does a lot, its ears are constantly twitching and moving during the, even when it's sleeping. It's got this randomly coated, randomly patterned, beautiful coat, with blacks and whites and browns and yellows and even reds in some cases. So each individual looks unique in that thing, in that way. And the final point is it's got these specially adapted self-sharpening carnassial premolar teeth, which are second only to the hyena in terms of size, relative size to the body. So they're specially adapted to tearing apart flesh, slicing and ripping it apart, which they do as soon as they catch an animal. They literally rip it to pieces within seconds, which sounds gruesome, but is actually very, very useful, because quite often their prey, having done all that work, a lion or a hyena will come along and steal it from them.
So just looking at, indeed, sort of why they're in decline, it sounds like there is a differentiation, very much so from the common dog that we would know, or indeed the common house dog that would be commonly used and or familiar with listeners. But could you maybe just speak to why they're in decline and what this sort of unique pictures looked like over the past few years and indeed contributed to the decline of the African wild dog?
Yeah, it makes him so surprising. I mean, I've told you how successful it is as a hunter, but its numbers have fallen dramatically from 1900. There was about 500,000 across Africa. Now there's only 6,500 left. So it is the most critically endangered carnivore in Africa. It's been persecuted for many decades. I mean, the British colonialists and others paid a bounty for people to bring in their tails and had posters up. So people actually made a lot of money trying to eradicate this, and farmers. But I mean, they do predate the odd goat and so on, but it was given a very bad name. So it was actively hunted just for elimination purposes. And still to this day, people in white farmers in South Africa and private farmers, should I say, will illegally shoot them, and there are hunter wildlife conflicts in many countries, particularly where there's a dense population, particularly Kenya or Zimbabwe, Tanzania and South Africa. So if they're pinching goats, local people will react, and that's a fact. However, a much larger number actually caught in poachers' snares, which are either accidentally poachers aiming for other things just to eat, or accidentally on purpose kept in snares. That's quite a high cause of death. Road kills where there's a particularly busy road. And last but not least, infectious diseases, rabies and distemper, particular risks in Angola, northern Botswana, northern Mozambique, Samburu, Laikipia in Kenya, Senegal, Tanzania, Zambia, Zimbabwe. So all of those countries, that is a significant risk, is spillover from domestic dogs. And finally, the natural causes, or would be lion and hyena, which can attack wild dog, and there is this natural competition going on there, but that seems to be the least of its troubles. I mean, the populations will rise and fall, particularly if the lion kill an alpha female and the pack disperses, but they do tend to bounce back from that.
So just looking at the migration of the African wild dog throughout Africa, and just looking at the sort of the map of how it migrates, because you just said there, the distribution is certainly not equal. There are sort of pockets, or indeed concentrated pockets of African wild dogs in certain areas, maybe across Kenya, indeed Tanzania and others. Could you maybe speak to the diverse migration of the African wild dog and where the sort of the focus, or indeed the concentration of dogs resides?
It's mainly in southern Africa, But particularly the largest populations are, as you said, in southern East Africa, and in the southern Salu, Nyerere national parks and adjacent Nyasa parks in northern Mozambique. But overall, it's mainly southern Africa, and with little pockets out in Senegal, some up in Libya, tiny little remnants that we find and we get very excited about. But the main areas are in southern and central southern Africa, outside of the DRC. In terms of migration, they don't actually migrate for fun, but they can cover huge distances as individuals. So they will expand within their range and try not to use up the prey. So they will go off in one direction for one hunt, and then another one, and another one, and then they will move on to a new area. But when a pack or when a couple of individuals want to leave a pack, they may then walk for hundreds of kilometers. And we've got cases, documented cases, where some have moved from northern Botswana right across Zimbabwe and been picked up in Mozambique, and they've evaded all the human settlements along the way. Others from Luangwa have come down, crossed the Zambezi and into Manapouls, looking for new a new pack to team up with. So and also down to the Waterberg in South Africa. So there's huge distances, and that's a factor in terms of disease control.
So looking at the elements of, sort of the behavior of the African wild dog as a pack, could you maybe speak to the succinct or indeed distinct behaviors that the African wild dog exhibits as a pack?
Well, as a pack is the key word. I mean, everything is for the pack. So they're a deeply social animal and very interdependent. And perhaps more so than almost any other canid. So everybody plays their role, and they do a lot of social bonding, even after they've been for a hunt or even asleep, a 7-hour nap or something in the afternoon. They wake up and lick each other and greet each other like they haven't seen each other for weeks. It's delightful to watch and a bit odd. you know, are they just exchanging what their dreams were? Who knows? But they do a lot of licking, as most dogs do. Unusually, that they're led by most animal terms, they're led by a female alpha who makes all the decisions, and she will pair with an alpha male. But it's thought that perhaps this feminine leadership is one of the reasons why they're so socially cooperative. That's one thing. Other individuals also have maybe designated a role. If the alpha female is out hunting with the others, another dog will be put, usually a teenager or juvenile, shall we say, in charge of the pups to look after them. If an animal is injured, another one will be delegated specifically to lick the wounds of that one until it's better. So there's no cross contamination. That will be the nurse dog. So they're very cooperative, and unlike, for example, the Lion Society, when it comes to feeding, pups get first dibs, and injured animals. So they genuinely look after each other before the others will have any of the food, which is one of their delightful traits.
So looking at different various elements, actually, Jim, around looking at their habitat, so how much of their habitat has been lost and or indeed affected directly by some of the factors you mentioned earlier around the poachers, habituation of ground by villagers or indeed populations. What do it look like on the ground from loss of habitat perspective, from a loss of habitat perspective?
I mean that's a problem throughout Africa, throughout the world, is humans competing for space and for resources, and it's not equally distributed in Africa. I mean, so, you know, South Africa, for example, is much more settled, and Zimbabwe than other places. My country, Zambia, is blessed with having still quite large tracts of natural vegetation and so on. So it's very variable, but yes, like anything else, they're very susceptible to intrusion and fire. And that's a big problem in Zambia, is that people just like burning things, burning forest to clear it for partly to feel safe, partly for slash and burn agriculture. And if you destroy the vegetation, you destroy the prey, you lose but that's just one factor, and that affects all animals across the continent. So it's part of the equation, but it's not the only thing.
So looking at the actual problem of rabies, indeed the spread of rabies, could you maybe speak to how prevalent it is throughout this species of dog?
Well, it's not. It's not at all. I mean, that makes, if you do studies on African wild dog and you look at packs, and there have been studies from Kenya, there have been studies from Zambia, and you do seroprevalence studies on the dog, on the African wild dog, they're almost all negative. That they've, you know, there's a few that have picked up from some previous exposure somewhere, but you know, it's a short-lived animal, and so it's not something that, what I'm trying to say is it's not something that they actually carry, but they're very vulnerable from introduction from outsiders. And when I mean outsiders, I mean domestic dogs, occasionally domestic cats, occasionally yellow mongoose. But it's mainly contact with the domestic dog will bring rabies into a pack, and then it go right through the whole pack very quickly because of this licking behavior and greeting behavior and so on. And so they're very vulnerable, and can then wipe out the entire pack. And if it hits the alpha female, the pack disintegrates. So it's... there's been a recent study by Susie Gold, it's unpublished, just done a PhD on it, unpublished data, looking at 14 outbreaks across the continent. And there were 261 individuals, but 225 of those died following the confirmed rabies outbreaks. So that's 86%, and others will have dispersed and found new homes or new packs. But very devastating. But of particular interest to me in that is that of the 17 individuals that they knew had been vaccinated, and these are very small numbers, 11 of those still died of rabies. The postmortem showed they died of rabies. So they'd been vaccinated against rabies, but presumably only had one dose of it, if we can think of the worst case scenario, and it presumably had been in the same subcutaneous route that we give it in veterinary practice. So that's a really rubbish outcome for what we consider in human medicine, that this is the most effective vaccine in human medicine. It's 100% protective. That's what I tell my patients, 99.99% protective. And that has puzzled me, and we can talk about that later, about some research that I'm planning to do in that area. And because then, unlike foxes, I mean, in Europe, we've been able to vaccinate a lot of wild animals through oral vaccines, just baiting meat. Wild dog don't scavenge. They only eat what they've killed fresh. So you can't, it doesn't work trying to provide oral vaccine for that species anyway.
Could you maybe speak to and unpack so rabies is deadly to humans, but does it have the same effect on other animals such as wild dogs? What's the kind of pathway or mechanism of action?
Right. Well, it affects mammals, and it kills them all except for bats. So bats are the reservoir throughout the world, and we need bats, but kill some bats, but a lot of bats can just keep it or tolerate it. And so that's why we'll probably never eradicate it fully from the planet, but we can eliminate it as a risk. So what gets from bats into other animals, particularly dogs, because of their bitey, licky behavior and other carnivores. But any animal that gets it will die, basically, unless it's properly vaccinated. That's a fact. We know of one human who's made a full recovery from rabies, symptomatic rabies, ever. And we know of 30 humans who've had some exposure and got antibodies, but obviously it wasn't enough to get into the nervous system, or was lucky. But that's it. It has the highest case fatality rate of any infectious disease that we know of.
So looking at, so rabies is one indeed illness or disease that's been attacking the African wild dog. But could you maybe also speak to the canine distemper virus, as this CDV, and indeed, does it pose a significant risk to the African wild dog? Could you maybe speak to the sort of disease profile as well, just for listeners?
It does too. Yeah. Excuse me. Number one is rabies for African wild dog. But a close second is canine distemper virus. The main difference is that rabies only needs one introduction into the wild dog pack, or into an individual. If you're bitten by one animal, you will get it, or there's a strong chance you will get it. Canine distemper virus, which is from which that has crossed species into humans, has now become measles. You need a larger pool, or not larger reservoir, for that to get going. But it is also a problem, and it is thrown into the mix in the 5-pentavalent vaccine that most vets give. So it's a standard thing that if you are vaccinating against one, why would you not vaccinate against canine distemper? There's also canine parvovirus as well, and that uses a marker of contact with other animals when some of the more serious ones aren't present. But they may just be killing out your subjects anyway. So in the study, we look for that too. But I'm sorry, I'm not a vet, and I'm not an expert on canine parvovirus. I'm a medical doctor, so that's yeah. But yeah, rabies and distemper are the two main killers.
So, Jim, could you maybe just speak to some of the research and indeed initiatives which you have been looking into to sort of mitigate the problem, especially the problem of rabies?
Well, there's lots of people doing lots of good work all over the continent in terms of research, and that's very exciting. Some of it locally inspired, some of it from outside, and that's all a good thing, and you can understand why it's fun to work with these beautiful animals. I know of at least three carnivore or conservation agencies that are directly trying to tackle the problem of rabies in African wild dog, and there are perhaps more, but I just happen to know in my searches there's only three that I found that have gone for it, and that's the Zambia Carnivore Program. There's a Nyasa Carnivore Project in the north of Mozambique, and the Samburu Laikipia Wild Dog Project in Kenya. So, and what they've said, mainly been doing is vaccinating domestic dogs in the area to try and produce herd immunity around a national park or protected area. It's good PR as well. It provides direct, tangible benefits to local people. I mean, people don't have to live with the fear of this animal so much, either for their own working dogs, for their children, but it also indirectly protects the African wild dog. So that's the main thrust, is indirect vaccination of other dogs has been the main thing. But in addition to that, as well as wildlife focused initiatives, across Africa, there's a big push to get rid of rabies. People care about the disease. I've grown up there. I know the fear firsthand, and as a parent and as a child of this awful disease, and it must strike utter fear into the hearts of rural people when they hear their child's been bitten. So most countries, well, all countries are doing something, whether it's national laws or programs to try and vaccinate dogs. And there's bigger international organizations like Mission Rabies and other players. And that's great. And I've been quite heartened to see that. I mean, as I say, I've worked in northern Mozambique where things are not quite so well resourced. That was all done on much of a voluntary basis on Ibo Island, where local people had taken the initiative and recruited a vet from Maputo to come up, and had been paid for by a charity. But there just really wasn't a vet nearby. The nearest vet was Pemba, in Pemba, which was 6.5 hours to get to, you know, by a dhow and then a sherpa. And, you know, it may be the law in Mozambique, but to get there, to get your dog vaccinated is very difficult. But I've been very heartened in Zambia, where on my last two visits last year, where just to see how many vets there are on the ground in rural areas, and animal health assistance in right down to village level. But it's not everywhere. So, and that's what we're trying to do. The thing with rabies elimination is you've got to get 70%. Once you hit that magic number, you get herd immunity and the risk falls. But if you don't get that number, you've wasted a lot of time and energy and money. And we found that in Chad and Mali, where two very similar countries, where in Mali they went about it, don't want to say the wrong way, but it wasn't effective, and they got 23-24%, which was a waste of time. Rabies was still there. They lost the initiative. They lost the good faith, the goodwill that people had put in. So you need to get everybody on board. You need to get from faith healers to village elders to children in schools, school teachers, everybody bought into this thing and get that this is, we're doing this for everybody, and then you get success. And naturally, with large relatively low population countries like Zambia, for example, you're going to find border areas or gaps far away from a road where people just aren't going, these services aren't going to get to those people there. And have you seen the way that the African wild dog is traveling right through these areas? That's the kind of, and it's not only wild dog, there's other wildlife is moving huge distances. So if there's rabies there, it's going to keep getting to be spread. So we've got to get every corner. So that's what I'm trying to do is that's what I'm, in my semi-retirement, is to go back home and try and fill in the gaps. I'm not trying to undermine, but to try and support and fill in the gaps that it's not reaching and identify the gaps. Partly just to get rid of this awful disease for our kids, and also for our wildlife. But it's not only vaccinating dogs, there's vaccinating high-risk humans. The dog handlers that are bringing in these animals for trapping them, catching them, bringing them in. And there's the young boys, mainly, who are out there, out in the bush, looking after cattle and goats for weeks on end, who will have a dog to protect them and a sleeping mat and a tarp or something. But that dog is crucial. But that's the dog that we need to vaccinate. That's the one that's going to be encountered with wildlife, not the fat, lazy one lying around the village. So we need to get those kids in and vaccinated. That's my plan. But as a side project to that initiative, which I'm doing through with the Ministry of Health, we're also trying to do set up a real-world perspective study on rabies vaccination in African wild dogs, directly vaccinating the dogs. Because it's fine to have this indirect strategy, but we've got a very effective vaccine. Why don't we use it in these dogs? And we'll be comparing intramuscular, intradermal, subcutaneous, and an unvaccinated So when all these people are doing the studies and collaring animals, all that exciting stuff, get the vets to do a prospective study. So that's the cunning plan, to start that in Zambia first and hopefully spread it across the continent. We obviously don't want an outbreak of rabies to happen, but should it occur, at least we'll get some valuable data, because the trouble with rabies is it's so awful. You can't ethically expose an animal experimentally to this virus. But the in human medicine, if I do intradermal rabies mainly, have done since 1999, some of us would say that is the most effective. Others would argue intramuscular is as good. It doesn't matter. They're both near enough 100%. But if I go subcutaneous when I'm giving my intradermal, I will hit myself on the wrist, apologize to the patient, and do it again, because that's considered not adequate in human medicine. And yet vets are giving it subcutaneously. I get that for herd immunity. It's very easy. The dog doesn't even notice. You grab it by the scruff of the neck, stick it under, release the dog. It's over. But if for these high-risk animals or very precious animals like the African wild dog or feral dogs that we're only catching once to sterilize, neuter, vaccinate, deworm and release, like we were doing in Mozambique, you need to perhaps use intramuscular or intradermal. So that's the cunning plan. We're going to do a big study on that, which I'm hoping to set up between University of Edinburgh, University of Zambia, and one of the key players in Zambia. But I can't mention that for now, just the actual name, until we've got that all signed, sealed and delivered.
That's fantastic, Jim. And to your point, actually, it mandates, like you said, a holistic strategy, actually, that incorporates and engages with various points within society. But also, I think it is, as you quite rightly say, all about the data, because then what you can do is you can then present the data to different countries within the African continent and say, look, this works. This is the evidence. This is the data that dissemination works. And then you can build it from there. So I think like you said, it's a fundamental key that is data driven, and that you can then go to other prospective governments, or indeed, different ministries and come back with the data.
And local people, I mean, if you explain to them the basic thing about the 70% magic number, I mean, people are not stupid and they do care. But the trouble is, people might have to walk large distances to get to get their dog vaccinated. There's a lot of effort. And if they don't fully, if you haven't got them fully on board, as I believe the case was in Mali, then, as I say, you're wasting your time. You need to get everybody prepared and do the human public health groundwork first, and ask them when they want this to happen, put them in charge of it, and getting ownership, and then we bring the vets in. But we've addressed all, I mean, vaccine hesitancy, as we've seen with COVID, is a big problem throughout the world. People have suspicions about some strange new medicine, and it's very easy for rumors to start that this is going to make my working dog less strong or less potent. And even when we're offering sterilizations in some parts of Africa, in India, you want to sterilize the animal and release it because that stops a rebound population. Trying to persuade people to get their dog sterilized is a bit more tricky, even if it's all for free. And you've got to do it right. So, and get everybody on board and answer, let everybody air their fears and their worries, and we can address them and discuss them properly and then do it. And then everybody can see that dog's got a splash of red on its head. That one's been done. The chief's one's been done. The school teacher's one's been done. So, you know, why is your dog not being done? And we do it all at once, and then we all pat ourselves on the back and we say we've got X percentage coverage, and that's pretty good compared with our neighbours in the next district or something. It works if you use community-led public health, and that's something I feel quite strongly about, and something I've had some experience with, as I say, in Mozambique and Madagascar. It's work from the bottom up. People are not daft, and they all care about their children.
So, Jim, as we're coming into land on the conversation, just is there any sort of take-home messages you'd like to infer for listeners? Indeed, either around the disease, the prevalence, or indeed around, like you said, the precious numbers of the African wild dog, and what people should be mindful of.
Well, firstly, speaking on the dog, it's a wonderful, enigmatic animal from which I think we can learn a lot from its behaviour, and I don't just mean scientifically. I just, I mean spiritually. It's a wonderful animal just to observe. I could watch them for hours. Other key points, despite it being an efficient hunter, there's no record of an African wild dog ever attacking or killing a human. And that compares with 25,000 humans who lose their lives through rabies in Africa from a dog. So the domestic dog is killing that 25,000 more per year than the African wild dog. And most of its threats are man-made, whether it's snares or rabies, road traffic accidents, even climate change is now a threat, to survival of pups. So from the wild dog perspective, those would be the main points. From the rabies side, although it's a disease of extremes, although it is the most serious disease known to man, or the highest, it is eminently preventable. I'd say we've got the most effective vaccine in humans. Why can't we get that into animal health as well? I'm sure there's lessons we can learn in animal health from as I say, doing a cross study. And we would certainly be able to bring those back into human medicine and settle once and for all the arguments that I hear whenever I go to an international conference on travel medicine, between is intradermal better than intramuscular, where's the data, blah, blah, blah. This is real world data. What actually protects you against this disease in the real setting? And we can do some good at the same time. So there is optimism, and hopefully we will get rabies eliminated from Africa. The target is 2030. That's the WHO target, and most governments are now signed up to that. As with anything, these things sometimes take a decade or two later, but to really mop it up, and that's where we need to focus, is these other areas. But we don't want to wait for an outbreak or even an individual case before we know that it's failed. We want to do it thoroughly the first time around.
My thanks, Jim, for this conversation. I think it's hugely important to both raise awareness, but also, like you said, to really get collective agreement on the way forward, both from a strategy and an implementation perspective. So thank you. And thank you just for laying that out as well, because it's hugely important that it is a holistic approach to this issue. So thanks for your time, Jim. Just as we come into land, is there anywhere you'd like to signpost people to if they want to look for further information around indeed either vaccines or indeed the African wild dog itself?
Where do I start? I mean, rabies. Sorry, some water went down the wrong way. There are lots of good initiatives on rabies, and from Global Alliance and Rabies Control and other things. The main thing on that side, I would just say, is if you haven't got vaccinated and you're a traveller or an expeditioner, get vaccinated. It's cheap. It's very effective, and if you get it intradermally, it's relatively painless. And so that should be for any of us going out into on expedition or disaster zones. That's where things will rabies outbreaks happen. It's following an earthquake in Haiti or something. So, but you don't need to particularly search the internet for that. Go to a travel clinic and get your rabies. In terms of the African wild dog, as I say, a number of very good organisations that are promoting it. It's now become sexy, which it wasn't when I was in the safari business as a 19-year-old. you know, you, it was just another thing, wild dog. Everyone was after the big five. But now people are just, you know, they've fallen in love with this thing. It is a beautiful animal. It is just lovely. And, you know, as a photo, whether it's for photo ops or just to watch, it's now becoming a must-see. And I would strongly encourage people to go and see it. Go to Africa and look for it and pay the reasonable price to stay somewhere. You may or may not see it. They're wild animals. They may decide to venture off somewhere else and you may strike unlucky. Hey ho. But yeah. Watch David Attenborough's thing on Dynasty. What else do you need to know about the African wild dog? It's a beautiful animal. It sells itself.
Many thanks, Jim. Listen, that's hugely insightful and indeed helpful from a broad range of perspectives, really. So thank you for your time, actually, over these last 40 minutes. And, for your perspectives.
Yeah, no worries. And the key word is One Health. That is, it's a double word, but that's what we're trying to do. You know, it's something I strongly believe in, bringing human and animal health together for the benefit of all. Anyway, thanks, Owen, and sorry to keep you up so late. Okay. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the episode. Please feel free to rate, review, and subscribe on whichever platform you're listening to. Please also head over to the World Extreme Medicine website, where you can find more engaging content on extreme medicine webinars and indeed the collection of courses from our global network, including humanitarian, disaster relief, expedition, space, military, tactical, and performance medicine. Thanks again.